This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. We've got a special guest today. We've got Dr. Gilbert Simon. And Dr. Simon's the author of a book, Ripped Off, Overtested, Overtreated, and Overcharged, The American Healthcare Mess. Dr. Simon, welcome to the show. Can you give us a quick introduction and tell us about the book and how we got here in the American healthcare mess?
Okay, well, the book was written to recruit more angry consumers, because once we have enough angry consumers, we'll be able to change the status quo. So the status quo is such that the American healthcare system is the most expensive and provides only, at best, mediocre care when compared to other worldwide peers. So we got here very insidiously through about a 70-year period of corporations slowly working their way into the healthcare system and slowly taking over each of the elements of healthcare. They did this very slowly, and they did it in a way that the consumers were only aware of the benefits and not aware that this was a deal that's going to lead to devastation down the road, which is where we're heading.
How do we change it? I think, you know, we've got 330 million people in aging population. We have less and less doctors per capita, less and less nurses per capita. How do we change the system so that it's more effective, so people have access to specialists, access to care? How do we change the system so it works better?
Well, for one, we need to strengthen the role of the primary care doctor. We are, again, unique among other countries in having a weak primary care system and a very strong specialty system. The strong specialty system leads to overtreating and overcharging. The stronger the primary care, the less need there is for down the road palliative care of neglected chronic diseases. So the first thing is to strengthen primary care. And we do this by increasing residency programs and by compensating them at the same level as other doctors are compensated. So primary care is one of the main ways of doing this. But the other way is to let the consumer realize how much he's paying for health care. They very seldom have any knowledge of what health care costs and what role they play in the over-consuming, driving prices up, and then they're stuck either paying the tab, which counts as a big surprise to them, or else paying it other ways, through the taxes or through flat wages.
But between deductibles and insurance, you know, an average family might be paying $20,000 plus a year, it readily, and obviously not sustainable. Do we get to the spot where there's such a daunting mismatch of resources versus people that we've got to go much more towards a preventive healthcare system? I mean, you talk about that. I mean, that's what they're doing in some of the largest countries in the world, just far more focused on prevention because they don't have the resources at the back end. Do we just have to accelerate so aggressively prevention that they try and avoid the daunting burden on the back end where we just don't have the resources to cure for people that are so sick and so unhealthy?
Well, first we have to get the consumers aware that the an ounce of prevention is no longer worth a pound of cure. It's worth a ton of cure because cure has become so expensive. So we need to do much more in the way of prevention. You know, we have only 60% of eligible people for colon cancer screening get screened. 60%. 60%.
Yeah, no, it's a travesty, quite frankly. Yes. And how do you deal with that? How do we get people more on board with it and all those things?
By making them responsible for their health care, by teaching them this is their job to be aware that it's their duty to take care of their health care, be aware of what the recommendations are, be aware of where they can find information about recommendations, and then advocate for themselves that, you know, I'm due for this, I want this, and to get this. And then and the opposite is also true. When too much is recommended, when they recommend another colonoscopy 7 years after the first one, they can say, no, the recommendation is 10 years, not 7 years. So becoming more actively involved, becoming their own advocates is a major step. I was in Los Angeles about 10 years ago when one of the major food marketing chains, I think it was Ralph's, announced that they were changing their health insurance from absolutely no cost to any of their employees to a $5 copayment. they went berserk. They went on strike for 3 months. It's supposed to be free. They had no idea they had to make a copayment.
And what's happened in our society that people feel so powerless over their health care? I mean, I think people more and more feel powerless. When you get COVID, you call, you say you got COVID, and the doctor says there's nothing we can do about it. And people just feel more and more powerless over things. So how do we change that mindset to people feeling empowered again, you know, and feeling in control of some of their health care situations?
That's a million-dollar question. But my approach has been through education, to giving them all the facts and letting them know that they can get a COVID immunization, get their boosters, and then not die of COVID. That's within their grasp. They can do that sort of thing. And by overcoming the disinformation, of which there's a great deal of, and that's confusing and mitigating against the approach to empowering the patient.
How do you deal with disinformation when all of us value free speech so much? How do you sort of deal with this? How do you find a fine line between, you know, free speech and disinformation? Because I hear that a lot, but I'm also a huge proponent of free speech. How do we find a balance there?
Again, this is another million-dollar question. And the question of free speech versus disinformation doesn't just apply to medicine. It applies to everything. And we are currently experiencing an outbreak of gun violence. And you hear all sorts of bizarre explanations as to how this comes about. And it's just appealing to the common sense of most of Americans. Most of us have brains. Most of us can figure things out. And most of us are, if they receive their news from a reliable source, they will make the correct decision.
100%, but it's very complicated to choose what is a reliable source. And so, Dr. Simon, tell us, you know, your favorite thing about your book. What's your favorite thing, the favorite chapter you wrote, the favorite piece of it that you find the most interesting? Talk to us about that a little bit.
Well, the book is really 11 chapters, but it's founded around six major areas where healthcare is deficient and overly expensive. So I have a lot of favorite. They're all favorite chapters of mine, but probably the most favorite was the chapter on fraud. I had no idea how much fraud goes on in the healthcare system. It's 100 to 200 to $300 billion a year in fraud, and almost all the fraud comes down to what's called the False Claim Act, where somebody does something or doesn't do something, makes an erroneous claim to get billed and paid, and that amounts to hundreds of billions of dollars a year that we lose. So what I liked about this chapter was that I broke it down into two categories: the fraud committed by individuals, fraud committed by organizations, and they're very different in their basic nature. Because individual fraud is usually done by a small player. It's usually some outrageous scheme that is caught almost immediately, and the job is for the fraudster to make as much money as he can as fast as he can, and then to get out as fast as he can. And that's the small time fraudster, but they can steal up to millions. And those are the doctors who operate on people who don't need surgery. Those are the cardiologists, the cardiovascular surgeons who put in stents when there's no need for a stent. The oncologists who treat with cancer treatment where there's no cancer present. Those are the individual fraudsters. But the big time fraud is committed by organizations, the major large players who feel they can very subtly tweak the guidelines and tweak the rules and steal a little bit, not a lot, a little bit, but over a long period of time and amass a huge fortune. And the best example of that is the example of Columbia Hospital / Hospital Corporations of America, the organization headed by the great senator from Florida, Rick Scott. He managed to acquire two small hospitals in Texas as a lawyer with no background in medicine, bought two hospitals, and realized how much cash he could make from those two hospitals. And he did it by cutting back on services, necessary services.